This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, Homo sapiens were once thought to be the only species that buried its dead. But an international team of scientists, including UW researchers, say they found evidence of graves made by an ancient human ancestor 100,000 years before the first known burials. We'll talk to one of those researchers about his work. But first, some people who worked remotely during the COVID-19 pandemic have returned to the office, and some employers are moving to limit remote work any further. But as Gabby Vinnick reports, in some rural Wisconsin communities, the opportunity to work remotely has given people more freedom.
Are you a good girl?
Yes, you are. You're a good girl, Bee.
On a sunny Friday afternoon, Laura Isaacson's dog, Bee, wants to play. After a few pets for her chocolate lab, Isaacson sits back at her computer at the kitchen table. She's surrounded by bookshelves, and she has light shining through the windows of her home in Mount Horeb. It's a different experience than her time working as a dietitian for the last 20 years. She would often drive to and from the hospital in the dark. Her commute took roughly 30 minutes to Dodgeville. Now, Isaacson works from home as a diabetes care and education specialist for a San Francisco-based company. She's one of more than 400,000 remote workers in Wisconsin.
I am so much happier right now. I don't think I even realized before how stressed out I was. Trying to balance being a mom and working full-time outside of the house.
Isaacson is one of millions of people who first worked remotely during the pandemic. Today, as many as 40% of workers nationally say they do at least some of their work from home. There are signs that some plan to return to the office. In April, a Morning Consult poll found nearly half of U.S. employees prefer working in person. And a Pew Research survey in March found that remote workers tend to say it hurts their opportunities to be mentored. But Isaacson says she has no immediate plans to return to the office, and working from home has given her more flexibility.
That's something I think a lot of moms struggle with. You feel really guilty trying to find that balance. And for me, the flexible schedule, not having a start time or an end time, and just being able to work when it works for me and works for my family, huge difference.
In Mineral Point, Rachel Bergstrom speaks with a client on Zoom from a small room in her farmhouse.
Yeah, Friday afternoons are really flexible for me after 2, so.
She's an education consultant for a Texas-based company. Not long ago, this meeting would have been impossible. She says their Wi-Fi would not have been stable enough to run. But in recent years, millions of federal and state dollars have gone to expanding broadband access in Wisconsin. It now reaches more than 90% of state residents. That infrastructure has helped Bergstrom connect with colleagues all across the country. For her, remote work meant an end to years of leaving her home at 5 a.m. She had to wake up early to catch a ride on the state van pool to her job with the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. In all, she spent about 3 hours on the road.
I don't know that I coped with the commute. I think it took a bigger toll on me than I realized now that I have more time to think.
Jose Maria Barrero is a finance professor and co-founder of the nationally recognized Work From Home Research Project. He says a relatively low-cost state like Wisconsin could be a winner in the work-from-home economy.
I think Wisconsin is interesting in that it is a state that has both large urban areas and a lot of rural areas. And so I think it has an opportunity to perhaps decongest the congested parts of the state.
Barrero says if rural areas have greater access to high-income workers, that could be a boon for local economies. But more work from home also means less foot traffic to urban downtowns, which creates its own challenges. Back in Mineral Point, Bergstrom says she hopes remote work possibilities benefit small towns like hers.
Maybe kids will stay in their small towns more because they can find a job programming, or they can find a job in an industry that's really booming, even if there's not a huge company here that does that.
Remote work is already shaping policy in new ways for Wisconsin, and Bergstrom is one of thousands who has no plans to get back to the office. Gabby Vinnick, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, an international group of scientists say they found evidence that an ancient human relative, the species Homo naledi, buried their dead. The archaeological evidence may go back 140 to 240,000 years earlier than the earliest known human burials at Kafsa Cave in Israel. If this is true, it may change what we think we know about the evolution of our species and what it means to be human. What do you want to know about the evolution of our species, Homo sapiens, and how we got where we are today? Do you have questions about the discovery of the Homo naledi species and the discovery of thousands of bones of ancient human ancestors that have been discovered by our next guest? Join us 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. John Hawks is a professor and associate chair of anthropology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's a paleontologist helping to lead the field work in analysis of the Rising Star Cave in South Africa, where Homo naledi were first discovered. And John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about this discovery of this species, Homo naledi, and how you came across it.
You know, we first discovered the bones in 2013. They are in a very, very deep part of the cave system that is actually it's accessible to us only through a 12-meter climb, about a 40-foot climb that has areas that are only about 7.5 inches wide. That is incredibly challenging. And our team that work in the cave system, they worked underground and recovered bones that we recognized were not like anything that we'd seen before that's a human relative. And so that was our discovery about 10 years ago. We named the species Homo naledi, and it is actually the largest fossil discovery in any single site in Africa.
How is the Homo naledi different than us, the Homo sapiens?
So Homo naledi lived around the same time as the earliest members of our species, Homo sapiens, between 250,000 and about 330,000 years ago. The species was different. It was similar to us in that it walked upright like we do. It was the size of kind of small statured people, so about between about 4'6" and about 5'2" tall. They walked like us. They were much better at climbing. Their pelvis is a little bit differently shaped than us. Their teeth tell us that they had a pretty high quality diet. They were eating a diet a lot like humans do, but their brains were only a third the size of ours. So they seem to share relationship with us sometime deep in our ancestry, more than a million years ago.
Wow. John, how has this discovery of the Homo naledi changed what we know about human history or the evolution of the genus we belong to?
A couple of really big points. One of them was that, you know, we learned that we weren't alone when we first evolved. You know, people know that humans today have an African origin. This species lived in South Africa at the same time that our species was originating in Africa. So, you know, we know that we've got ancient relatives. We didn't expect that we would have one right at the time and place where our species was getting started. And that was a big deal. The other was that this species must have had something going for it in order to survive alongside of other humans and human relatives that had brains that were three times its size. We wondered, what is going on with this species? How is it able to persist in an environment where it's competing potentially with other species that are really, you know, we think are cognitively better? And how did its bones wind up in this mysterious place?
John Hawks, is the hypothesis then that the cognitively bigger might not necessarily have equated to a cognitively better?
You know, what we're finding is that this species was using large parts of this deep cave environment. We found it in different parts of the cave system. In our most recent announcement, we show that at least two of the bodies that we found were placed into holes and covered. So they were buried. And we found engravings in the chamber where we have some of these bodies. And so that evidence combined says that maybe it's not big brains that are really driving some of our at least cognitive social abilities.
Yeah. So if we have evidence now, and if you've uncovered evidence in these caves in South Africa that there was a burial ritual, what does that imply about this species? And then what would you assume or what could we hypothesize about this species and its society?
You know, I think I look at ourselves, you know, every human culture in the world has some kind of ritual or practice that they do when someone dies. And they're varied. Some cultures, you know, maybe some that we're familiar with, bury bodies, right, in a very characteristic way. but many of them do other kinds of things. They cremate, they have, you know, expose the body to scavengers sometimes. They put bodies into rivers. You know, there's an amazing diversity of things that people do. But they share something really core, which is that it's a social ritual that enables the entire society to recognize that someone has left and to comfort people who may be really grieving, who are closely connected to the person that's died. And that's something that is actually very core to our being. It's something that we explain to our young children when someone dies. Of course, today we have tremendous, you know, religious ideas that, you know, that the, you know, theology that's centered around what happens when people die. But those things are very particular to different cultures. What's shared is that all of us have grieving, all of us have mourning, and as a society, people come together to do something to recognize that they all share it. It's a really powerful statement that there's something about humans that we share that's actually deeper than our species.
Oh, man. John Hawks, our guest, paleontologist and professor and associate chair of anthropology at UW-Madison. We go to your questions now at 1-800-642-1234. Marcus in Milwaukee, you're on the air.
Hi. So my question, Professor, is I've noticed that it seems like different groups, what were previously on the Homo sapien, like our family tree, you have Denisovans, you have Neanderthals, you have Homo naledi, and they're all so, Homo floresiensis, and they're all so spread out. It seems like they've almost been put onto like certain parts of the map to keep them separated, like it was a seeding type experiment. And I guess I'd like your thoughts on that. And on burials, wouldn't that indicate that they had belief in God or some sort of afterlife or religion when you start having ritualistic type burials?
Is there a suggestion of the belief system in place there, John?
That's a great question. And I'll just take the second question first. You know, today people all over the world share, they all have some kind of mortuary ritual or funerary ritual. And that is constant in every culture, despite the huge variation they have in religious beliefs. Many cultures in the world don't have a conception of an afterlife. Many of them have, you know, different conceptions. And this element is something that all of them share. So I wouldn't ascribe to any ancient group something very particular to some cultures in the world today. It's something deeper than our religious ideas in a way.
And what about Marcus? Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. We have, in the last couple of decades, just tremendously discovered new things. Some of those discoveries, like ours, are coming from fossil exploration. Some of them are coming from genetic work. And I'm here in New York right now at a memorial conference, actually, for Richard Leakey. Richard died last year. He was a tremendous explorer and motivated work in Kenya and really was an inspiration to many of us. And what I'm learning here is just how much there is still to discover. You know, we've got fossil hominins in many parts of the world, but the parts that we have a lot of knowledge of are parts that we've worked for a long time. There is a lot of places where our work has only just started. And I think that you're going to see that we're going to begin filling up the map even more than it is already.
How exciting to find out that we still have so much more to find out. We're talking with John Hawks, UW-Madison paleontologist, about his work analyzing the remains of our human ancestor, the Homo naledi, found in the Rising Star Cave in South Africa. It is northwest of Johannesburg, as I understand it. And we'll continue our conversation, maybe hear from you at 1-800-642-1234, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn. And coming up, the local news industry continues to shrink with layoffs and newspapers downsizing or shutting down. We'll talk to one of the organizers of a new coalition that aims to revitalize local journalism. But right now, we're picking up our talk with UW-Madison paleoanthropologist John Hawks about new evidence that the Homo naledi, an ancient species related to us, may have buried their own dead and what that may mean to us. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. We'll go to Ben in Sparta next. Ben, you're on the air. Good afternoon.
New evidence that the Homo
Hi, Professor Hi. Hawks. I'm interested in what your current thinking is about the relationship. You know, the old idea of the relationship body-brain ratio, total neuronal mass and what we think of as intelligence, but there's been research with other animals, other species, birds, and other species exhibiting behaviors that we previously thought were too complex for the size of their brains. This discovery seems to follow up on that. So if, in fact, it's not the total number of neurons that contributes to intelligence, how does that work, in your opinion?
Interesting. Thank you, Ben. John?
So we've examined the inside surface of the skulls of Homo naledi. We've got some really high detailed evidence there. There's a limited amount that we can say about the organization of ancient brains from the fossil record. The brain is an organ that unfortunately doesn't fossilize, but we can see a few details about its shape from its external surface. That's an imprint on the inside surface of the skull. What we can see between humans and some of our very early hominin relatives is the frontal lobe is organized a little differently today. We've actually expanded parts of the frontal lobe that we today use for organizing language and have expanded parts of the frontal lobe relative to the other parts of the brain. With Homo naledi, see evidence that they had a human-like brain organization, at least in that respect. And that leads us to think that there may be something about the wiring of the brain that matters more than the sheer size of it. But that's not to say that size isn't relevant. I don't know what Homo naledi's behavioral capacities would have been in many aspects. I think that when we look at humans today and think, wow, you know, the brain solves every problem, we actually have to look at a finer resolution. We have to understand that we actually use different solutions for different problems, and that involves different brain tissues, and some problems that maybe we're really good at today are things that our big brain helps with, but some of these aspects that we consider to be deeply human actually might have originated earlier than big brains.
John Hawks, UW-Madison paleoanthropologist, joining us and answering your questions at 1-800-642-1234 about what he and his team have uncovered in the cave systems in South Africa. We'll go to Dennis in Two Rivers next. Dennis, good afternoon.
Hi. I was just thinking as far as, what's really the distinguishing between human and human-like? Because, I think people used to think, it was only humans that would use tools, but then, chimpanzees have been shown to use some like tools, and it would seem kind of using tools to dig a hole to put dead in would be quite an undertaking.
John, you part of your discovery seems to have been the suggestion that there may have been a tool buried with one of these Homo naledi. Is that correct?
It's entirely fascinating. In fact, I have news from one of my collaborators this morning. We have one of our burials. When we encountered bone, we removed it from the cave system in a plaster jacket, just like you would do a dinosaur bone to protect it. And our team had to bring it out of the narrow passageway. And once they were able to do that, we put it into a CT scanner and we visualized what was inside. That was how we discovered, really intact parts of a skeleton that were there. And near the hand bones of this skeleton was an artifact, a rock that was elongated, that had a sharp edge. And in the CT scan, we were like, wow, this is amazing. We have left all of this in the plaster jacket. We're not disrupting it in any way. We're using only virtual data for it. But to get better imagery of this rock, we actually had to take the whole thing to France to put in a special scanner that uses a synchrotron radiation to high energy microtomography. And we have imagery of this rock that is at the nanoscale. We have just amazing images. It's super interesting. It's not really characteristic of stone tools that we recognize by intentional multiple flaking being made, right? This is a very simple object. We don't know for sure that Homo naledi made it, but it is in a super interesting context in a place where we don't have any other rocks and we haven't found any other like this. And it's one of the sort of enigmatic parts of this. As scientists, we're like, okay, what do we do next? And in fact, my team is finding out new things to do with it. So it's going to be fun.
What are some of the arguments against the hypothesis that this is a burial site, that there is evidence that this Homo Naledi had to some degree a ritual for the dead and a way to mourn those that are lost?
You know, really, it's complicated when we're looking at ancient artifacts and ancient sites. When we talk about what happened to a body at the time of death today, we're talking about forensic science. You know, we're talking about really, you know, you want as much evidence as possible. The archaeological record degrades that evidence over time. And so as the evidence that we have, we can compare to early human burials, to Neanderthal burials, to other examples that we have, and we can show that a hole was dug here. A body was covered in it. But that's extremely hard to document at the level that a forensic scientist would. And so, you know, we do have archaeologists who are like, yeah, okay, you've shown me that there was a depression in the floor of the cave, but I really want, you know, hard evidence that this was actually buried at the time. We're fortunate that we have two examples, and they both present what we view as very strong evidence. But, you know, part of the scientific process is that degree of skepticism. And we have to expect that people are going to say, you know, we thought that this was a human behavior. We really, really want some very, very hard evidence for this. And that's what we do our best to provide.
Could you give us a brief, and I've only got about a minute here, John, explanation of what you are up to next and where your team will be looking to go forward?
We have not only this site, but a number of other sites with other species that we're investigating. But in Rising Star, we are really focused right now on doing a detailed mapping of the cave system with scanning, looking for more cultural evidence. We have to, you know, we have additional pieces of wall that are engraved in parts of the system, and we have to understand what the total system, what's there, to be able to possibly reconstruct something about the culture of this ancient human.
John Hawks, we look forward to talking to you again. So thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
John Hawks is professor and associate chair of anthropology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He talked to us today about his work with remains of ancient human relatives found at the Rising Star Cave in South Africa. Join Kate Archer-Kent for the morning show tomorrow as she finds out what's next for local journalism and hundreds of journalists who have walked off the job, insisting on an end to cost-cutting at the country's biggest newspaper chain. That's tomorrow morning from 7 to 9. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. Tonight at 6 on 1A Plus with Jen White, are we entering a new era of government transparency around UFOs? NASA is enlisting the public's help in their research around unknown objects in our skies. UFOs? Tonight at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, major media companies have gone through more rounds of layoffs in recent months, while smaller local news operations have struggled just to stay afloat. It's creating a challenging media environment that leads to less coverage and lower quality information for communities. It has journalists and advocates concerned about the future, so a group of them are teaming up to do something about it. The recently relaunched Rebuild Local News Coalition aims to develop new funding sources and push for policies to support independent, objective journalism to address the issues facing the industry today. Anna Brugman is the director of public policy for the Rebuild Local News Coalition, and I talked with her earlier this year. So for starters, who's all in this coalition?
So our coalition has nonprofit newsrooms represented by Institute for Nonprofit News, commercial digital-only sites, local independent online news publishers, weeklies, some dailies, rural weekly papers through a national newspaper association. It's a really broad coalition. There's Spanish-speaking publications and historic Black newspapers. Overall, there's 20-plus organizations that Rebuild Local News represents. And the idea is that we all work in concert together to advocate for public policies to support the future of the local press.
So what happened to the local press? Where did it all go? How did it lose its funding?
A long story, and it would honestly depend on where you began. I don't think we can start with the Industrial Revolution, but I'll start. I'll start in, we'll put in the 1990s, I guess. So the internet was obviously a huge disruptor to local news. And again, there's many great journalism historians that have much more sweeping local news histories than this one. But the internet was a massive disruptor to the business model of local news. It used to be that you would put your classified ads or advertisements into a local newspaper. And that became a platform for local businesses and even larger businesses to advertise to consumers. But it's not been that way for many, many decades. And that led to a slow and then very fast decline of local journalism. 2008, the recession was very hard on many local newspapers. That's not to say that there isn't innovation in the local news sector. I don't want to paint the whole picture. It's very bleak. There's tons of innovation happening. Something like 30% of nonprofit newsrooms didn't exist 5 years ago. There's business model innovation happening at local newspapers and commercial digital-only sites. But overall, we have almost 60% fewer local journalists than we used to. And that's really because of a stirrup of the business model and also changes in reader habits. So again, I won't start at the Industrial Revolution, but...
but you could.
But I won't.
Thank you, Anna.
You're so welcome.
One of the news stories that I've seen recently is about the Department of Justice's antitrust case against Google, saying that they've got a corner on the market of online advertising. Is that part of the problem for local journalism?
It is part of the problem for local journalism platforms and digital ad monopolies are part of the problem. But I think it's a piece of the problem, not all of the problem. Anytime you introduce new technology into journalism, there's a huge shift. There's a transition. This happened when we introduced television. Newspapers actually started doing more analysis when television was introduced because they were no longer the source for quick information. When radio entered the journalism market, there was a huge stirrup. There's always disruption anytime you introduce a new technology. And so to some extent that was to be expected. The way that Google and Facebook have colluded to corner the market on digital advertising is a problem, not just for local news outlets, but for small businesses generally. So that is, again, a piece of the problem, but I wouldn't say pin all the issue on that digital ad monopoly.
Anna Brugman, our guest, Director of Public Policy for the Rebuild Local News Coalition. And so what are some of these issues that this coalition is looking to take on?
Of course. And so we're looking at public policies that incentivize the hiring of journalists. And so the policy that we've been attending to the most closely in the last few years is something called the payroll tax credit, which sounds like the least exciting piece of public policy I could possibly imagine. But it is a very exciting piece of public policy. what it does is it provides a refundable tax credit to local news outlets that is calculated based on how much you pay your local journalist. And so this money goes to the news outlets. It doesn't go to the local journalist. And there is a cap on how much local news outlets can get on these tax credits. It was singled out and put into Build Back Better. Obviously, Build Back Better didn't pass. It was also included in the end of year omnibus in 2022. It got cut at the last minute, but we've been working very closely with this policy at the federal level. But then there are a series of other ones that we've been looking at the state and local level, refundable tax credits for small businesses to advertise in local media. And when I say local media and local news outlets, I'm not just talking about newspapers. I've mentioned nonprofits. Public radio is a great example of local journalism that
Thank
this
you.
Would benefit. You're so welcome. Commercial digital onlys. I use local news outlets very broadly, but the refundable tax credit to small businesses would incentivize small businesses to take out advertising in local news outlets. There's another one for subscribers. We're looking at municipal advertising allocations. So every government, city, state, federal, has an advertising budget for many of its projects like the Department of Health or,
sure.
Or your city's recreational department. There's an advertising budget. And much of that advertising budget, especially at the higher end government you go, doesn't go to local journalism. And so New York City tried a program where a certain proportion of some agencies' budgets had to be allocated to community newsrooms. Chicago just passed it as well. So we're also looking at scaling those sorts of programs. Those are the ones that have been introduced so far. We're also really interested in something called replanting, which would incentivize the purchase of newspapers from large chains into local hands. And so ideally that would be like a local trust or a public benefit corporation, incentivizing local ownership and disincentivizing non-local ownership. I will say that that small business tax credit that I talked to was actually introduced in Wisconsin last year and had, I believe, 16 co-sponsors. Representative Novak was the lead co-sponsor on that. And so it's not just, you know, the coastal states that are looking at this are states all around the United States that are interested in supporting their local press through public policy.
So how would you rebuild local news? 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation. What do you see in your local newspaper? Or how about your local nonprofit news source that you'd like to give a shout out to and what we can do to support them? 1-800-642-1234 to join us or email ideas@WPR.org with our guest, Anna Brugman, Director of Public Policy for the Rebuild Local News Coalition. So, Anna, if we're going to offer these payroll tax credits or offer tax credits at all for these local information sources, you'd have to make a case for the value for the rest of us or the value the rest of us would see in a robust local journalism. What's its value to me?
Oh boy, what a
I know.
Again, where to start? So I guess I could start by talking about what happens when local news leaves. And we've studied this mostly by looking at when local newspapers leave. For a very long time in our nation's history, local newspapers have provided kind of like the foundation of local news sources. So much of what gets up to national broadcast or national newspapers starts as a local story. And so local newspapers have for a long time provided the bedrock of not only accountability reporting, but also kind of the that social capital, those ties to community, the community features that remind people why they care about their community. People who read local news are more likely to volunteer. They're more likely to vote. They are more likely to take interest in a civic cause. And so you begin to appreciate what local news offers a community by studying what happens when something like a local newspaper leaves a community. And what we see is almost every metric by which you would measure civic health or the health of a community trends in the opposite direction as you would want when you lose local news in a community. And so that's voting rates. That's the number of folks running for an elected position. Incumbents are more likely to win elections when local news leaves. Polarization increases. There's a professor, I believe he's at LSU, Josh Darr, has done a lot of research on how local news affects polarization. Government borrowing rates go up. Bond ratings trend the wrong direction. Government waste goes up. I could go on and on and on and on. It's even more likely that communities without local news will have environmental disasters because there's fewer people watching corporate interests in those communities. And so there's fewer people who are able to point and say there is corporate malfeasance that could result in an environmental disaster. There have been some that have posited that it's more likely that infectious disease will spread without strong local news. It's hard to, it's almost every metric by which you would.
So
you
basically, would, yeah, what happens without local news? You have no idea.
And I think that there's, I'm going to say his last name wrong. And if he's listening, I'm sorry, Tony. He's a publisher in Iowa. He wrote a paper after he graduated from a program called New Start in West Virginia. And he wrote that it's really hard to to know which direction local news works in, whether it's a cause or an effect, but it is wrapped up into the economic health of a community. And so it's the economy, it's the government, it's civic life, it's pollution, it's health. I think a good way to think about it is like, when is the last time you cared about something in your community? When is the last time you were upset about something or found yourself feeling really proud of your community? And where did you read it? Where did you hear about it? And I would be willing to bet a lot of money. but I'm a journalist, so I don't have that much money. That should.
So not a lot to wager on that. We're talking with Anna Brugman from Rebuild Local News Coalition about the state of local journalism and efforts to support it. What would you do? 1-800-642-1234. What would you like to see? 1-800-642-1234. Or email us ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue our conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up the conversation with Anna Brugman. She's the Public Policy Director for the Rebuild Local News Coalition with us today to talk about the challenges facing local journalism outlets and some potential solutions. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Would you pay for more local news if a tax credit was available for it? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. And Anna, Tom in Milwaukee called in, couldn't stay on the line, but wants to know if there's any relationship between your organization and public broadcasting or just print media. What are some of the groups that are part of this coalition?
Well, hi, Tom in Milwaukee. We work very closely with public media. National Public Broadcasting is a member of the coalition, but we work very closely together. And we make sure that any policy that we are advocating for is what we call platform neutral or medium agnostic, which means that as long as folks hire local reporters, as long as you're transparent about your ownership, and as long as you're not owned or majority funded by organizations likely to have political motives, and you're probably local journalism, and you should probably be supported with any public policy. And so that's public radio, that's print, that's nonprofits, that's commercial digital onlys. We really are focused on the local journalism and who is likely to do that local journalism more than just the medium at hand.
And is there a name for the federal legislation for a payroll tax credit for media outlets?
So that was originally proposed in something called the Local Journalism Sustainability Act, which was introduced in 2021 for the second time. It is bipartisan in the House. It has a pretty broad spectrum of co-sponsors on that. And so if you look at the Local Journalism Sustainability Act, there are three pillars, which one is the payroll tax credit, one is the advertising tax credit, and one is the subscription tax credit. Mm. And so the payroll tax credit was singled out in Build Back Better, but was originally introduced as that big bundle of policies.
And Anna, if I'm a news devourer, not just a news consumer, but I just can't get enough, what more can I do to support the information, to get more information? What role do I play in this?
And so if there is a high quality news outlet in your area, support it, whether that be your public radio station, your local newspaper, your local nonprofit. I subscribe to a combination of all of those. And then you can support organizations that are trying to help other local news outlets. And so that's folks like American Journalism Project or Report for America, which our founder, Stephen Waldman, also helped found. American Journalism Project is in venture philanthropy. It's a very innovative organization that's working to kind of shore up the business side of local news outlets. Many of our members, in fact, do take donations, and they would be very excited to see more donors supporting their work of supporting local journalism. Report for America is a really interesting, full disclosure, it did work for them for a little bit, organization that places local journalists in local newsrooms that otherwise wouldn't be able to afford them, kind of similar to like Teach for America or AmeriCorps or the Peace Corps, but for local journalists in the United States. And so you can look for these organizations if you're looking for a way to do even more than just subscribe to your local news outlets that you feel provide high quality journalism for your community. You could look at those organizations to support as well.
Let's go to your calls and questions now at 1-800-642-1234, where Pat in Green Bay is standing by. Pat, good afternoon. You're on the air with Anna Brugman, Director of Public Policy for the Rebuild Local News Coalition.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my phone call. You know, I'm all for this public support, or I don't know. I'm sorry, your person that you're talking to, I can't keep up with her. She's very, very quick. But anyway, all I want to say is, you know, it's all good, but we need to do away with where we have one news source that's slanted towards the Democrats, one that's slanted towards the Republicans. That shouldn't have anything to do with the news. The news should be the news, not what corporate America wants us to see.
So how do we keep the partisan away from the information when it comes to journalism, Anna?
That's a great question. And I am sorry, I speak very quickly. I'll try to slow it down a bit. The qualifying language in a lot of the public policies that we're pushing, it does not have anything to do with the content that is produced. And so in terms of how public policy could enhance a perceived partisanship, we are actively, that is a pillar of our approach to pursuing public policy, is making sure that's not the case, is that no government official would be able to pick and choose which newspaper or news outlet would benefit from a specific policy. And we do that by constructing qualifying language that is more about the characteristics of a newspaper or a news website or a public radio station. Do you hire journalists? Do they live in the area in which they cover? Are they not funded by politically motivated folks? In terms of the journalism that is done, the public policy is actually, we intentionally distant from that because it would be a nightmare to us as journalists to pass policies that undermine the independence of the local press. That's our worst case scenario. And so I think that it's important to have conversations with your local newspaper and local journalists. Local journalists are people. I've been a little local journalist before. We're humans. And we would love to have a discussion with the folks that we cover about how we can improve our coverage. And I think that, I think part of that is what happens in the conversations we have with local journalists and our local newspapers. And our role in that is making sure that we have sustainable and thriving and vibrant local news outlets in all communities that can be a voice for the community. So I think that's our role in it.
And we've just got about a minute left here, Anna, but how would you respond to concerns people might have about the government being involved with regulating journalism or funding it?
Yeah, I think that's a real fear. And I think we don't want to disqualify that at all. And as I said, a major pillar of our policy pursuits is that they're content neutral, that we don't pass policies that put a government official in the position of picking which publications serve their interests. And we don't want journalism that serves government interests. As I said, the qualifying language, the definitions, the qualifying language, the really, really boring, wonky stuff is really, really important in these policies. And we think it's a huge responsibility to pass good journalism policy because we need more good journalism.
Yeah, the really, really boring stuff, which is what you do at the Rebuild Local News Coalition.
But we do.
Hey, Anna, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anna Brugman is the Director of Public Policy for the Rebuild Local News Coalition. She was with us today to discuss efforts to revitalize local journalism through its advocacy. A note of clarity here, Wisconsin Public Radio is not part of the Rebuild Local News organization. Our conversation from Anna was from earlier this year, but we still want to know what you think, and you can still comment at any time. You can email us ideas@wpr.org. Now, coming up tomorrow on Central Time, U.S. cancer centers are reporting a growing shortage of common cancer drugs, and it's forcing them to change the way they treat patients. Dr. Kerry Wasinski from the UW Health Carbone Cancer Center shares what's happening and why. Plus, also tomorrow, I don't have to tell you, it's Food Friday, and we'll be taking you out of the kitchen to cook in the wild. If you've got a cooler and a campfire, well, have we got the recipes for you. That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time from 3 until 6. Join us then online or over the air.